Out into the black desert.
I want this country to realize that we stand on the edge of oblivion.
I want every man, woman, and child to understand how close we are to chaos.
Can't get no sleep.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Alternatives to Thought. I'm Chel Marin, and I'm here with our normal co-host. We have Norman Schultz.
Good morning.
Brittany Rosenow.
Hey.
And we have Nick Arcus.
Good morning.
And today we have a special guest. We have Gleb Sipirsky. Did I say that right?
You did well. Yes, excellent job.
Awesome. So Gleb runs the Rational Politics Project for International Insights, a nonprofit devoted to promoting rational thinking in politics and other areas of life. The main focus of the Rational Project is Rational Politics Project is the Pro-Truth Pledge, which aims to reverse the tide of lies and promote truth through combining behavioral science and crowdsourcing. He's also a best-selling author. He wrote Find Your Purpose Using Science and Other Books, and is the author of the forthcoming Alternative Facts, Fighting Post-Truth Politics with Behavioral Science. And I believe today that is what we're here to talk about, is post-truth politics. Is that right?
That is definitely right.
Perfect. So, also, you are a history teacher at Ohio State. Is that right?
Yes, the history of behavioral sciences.
History of behavioral sciences. Okay. So, firstly, what got you interested in politics?
Well, so in the history of behavioral science, one of the things I examine, one of the reasons I went into it, is because I saw people around me when I was a kid, when I was a teenager. People around me making bad decisions. And behavioral science, one of the really important aspects of behavioral science is studying how people and how groups make decisions and how they go wrong and how you can address that. So I decided to focus specifically on politics as well as business. So in business and politics, kind of economics and politics, those were the areas where I saw people making disastrous decisions and all of us suffering as a result of decisions that people make that are bad on an everyday level, both individuals, private citizens, and political figures, and CEOs, and journalists. So all sorts of decisions that really harm our society. And I wanted to study that, and not only study that, so I decided not to be stuck in an ivory tower. I decided to be a science popularizer. And that's where I started the nonprofit Intentional Insights with my wife. She has an MBA in nonprofit management, so she actually knows how to run the operations, and I'm more the public figure. So that's why we started it. And, you know, there are many public intellectuals who are just doing their own individual public intellectual thing, but the reason I decided to start an organization is so that I can ally with many people together. And, you know, so if I'm hit by a bus, then my work won't stop. It will continue. And the mission of spreading truth and rational thinking in effective research-based ways will continue forward without me. That's why I'm interested in this, and that's kind of my background.
Gotcha. So I'm sure that you've been fairly active during this last election season.
I have been quite active. I've been publishing in mainstream venues, things like Time, the New York Daily News, things like Psychology Today, The Conversation, many other places I can list, many newspapers and so on. I've been on many prominent radio shows, on TV quite a bit, affiliates of ABC and Fox. Mm-hmm. And I've been quite vocal in the secular reason-oriented sphere as well. So my articles came out in The Humanist, Free Inquiries, Skeptical Inquirer, American Atheist magazine. I've been interviewed in Aaron Ra, The Ramen Podcast, The Scathing Atheist, The Humanist Hour, a whole bunch of other shows I could name. So to address and spread effective ways of fighting post-truth politics to reverse the tide of lies in our political system and promote the truth.
Sure. One of the themes of this last election seems to be sort of a pathological dishonesty.
It has been. It's definitely pathological dishonesty. But pathological is not necessarily the word I would want to use. Pathological implies that people are unable to tell the truth. Here, I think it's more just a indifference to the truth in terms of people, especially on the Republican side, according to polls and statistics and truth fact-checking websites, really have been telling the truth when it suits their interests and lying when it suits their interests without really discriminating between the two, making points that are the most convincing to their audience in order to get votes. So that has been the case in this election cycle in the US. It has been the case in the UK. It's been the case in a number of other countries. So it's not simply a US phenomenon. This is something that's much more broad and global.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like politics is becoming more and more, and maybe it's been this way for a long time, but it seems to be becoming more and more ideological rather than fact-based. So when I talk to a lot of people about current issues, political stances, it's not so much about the facts, but about shaping information to support a particular ideological review, regardless of what the facts say or what the data says.
Yes, so Oxford Dictionary chose post-truth politics as its word of the year in 2016, and it defined post-truth politics as appeals to ideology, to emotions and personal beliefs over facts winning out. So the difference between what it's, you know, post-truth politics, you know, it's sure, it's a shiny new word, you know, what is the difference between what happened in the past and what happened now? Well, the difference that Oxford Dictionary identified by choosing the word of as the word of the year in 2016 is that politicians who use post-truth politics win. Previously, appeals to facts, there were certainly lies, no questions about it, and plenty of politicians lied in the past, but overall, appeals to facts were seen as more valid and more important than appeals to ideology and personal beliefs, although some people still were reached by those appeals to ideology and personal beliefs, but many more people were reached by appeals to facts. So it's more of a tipping point. We have come to a tipping point where both in the UK and in the US, those who used very blatant and clear lies and also attacked those who called them out on their lies won in the big mainstream elections, both the Brexit and the presidential election in the US. So that's the difference between now and the past.
That's pretty depressing.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty depressing. No question about it.
Well, where do you think this shift in Western politics has came from?
A number of areas. One is the rise of social media. So people are getting their information much more. So we have statistics and polls showing that many more people are getting their news information about politics from social media. And social media is unfiltered, unlike traditional mainstream media, and also like the new online media, which is also not filtered, which is where articles on social media are coming from. So traditional mainstream media were filtered. You know, people can criticize corporate media and whatnot, but they had certain standards. They fired people when they found that people lied, the journalists lied, and so on. So they couldn't get away with blatant, clear lies. That wasn't something that happened in the mainstream media. And the information was filtered. So people who are ordinary people, if you imagine Joe on the street, and he is listening to, you know, ABC News or, you know, CNN or something like that, he's getting information that, while it may be spun in certain ways, is not a blatant lie. It's kind of, you know, okay. So he doesn't have to do much filtering of his own. It's like, whatever he watches, he can still be okay with getting relatively straightforward information if he watches kind of the mainstream news stuff. Now, what's happening right now is that social media enters the picture, and the digital media that gets distributed through social media in such a way that mainstream Joe on the street, who now gets his news mainly from social media, from Facebook, They are not. That's news that is not filtered. Now, he is still used to not filtering himself, not curating the news himself. So he is very vulnerable to being lied and deceived. I mean, we have so much information about the amount of lies that were prevalent in this presidential cycle. For example, in the last 3 months before the election, the top 20 fake news stories were shared more widely on Facebook than the top 20 real news stories. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
More widely, fake news stories were shared than real news stories. It's ridiculous, but it's true. And that's what people are impacted by.
It appeals to their confirmation bias, I think.
Yes, that's right. And confirmation bias is people's tendency to search for and take in information that basically appeals to their current beliefs, so confirms their current beliefs. So if you imagine someone who is not filtering news very well, and most people are not, you know, most people are not, they're not used to filtering news. They haven't been taught this. So they see two news stories. One is a real news story that has, you know, credible and so on. And the other one is an emotionally appealing story that appeals to, you know, mainstream Mary's beliefs. Well, which one is mainstream Mary going to listen to and which one is she going to share? People don't have an understanding. The vast and large majority of people don't have an understanding that there's a difference between what feels good and what is true. And they mistake their gut intuitions, what feels good to them, for what is true. And so therefore, they'll go like, well, there are two news stories. Which one am I going to listen to? I'm going to listen to the one that feels good. And that's unfortunately what happens. Okay. There's particular research from Stanford University showing that people also can't tell apart sponsored news stories from real news stories. So something like, if you go on the website of, you know, any website, let's say CNN, they have stories. Some stories are real that CNN produces, and some stories are sponsored content from others, which can be, you know, mainstream, which can be, you know, from companies, or it could be from advertising, from various campaigns, from Clinton's campaign, Trump's campaign.
Could be from a rich dude.
Yes, absolutely. From companies, exactly. From, you know, whether, and the rich dudes, whether it's Robert Mercer on the conservative side or George Soros on the liberal side. You know, so kind of, I'm not, you know, making a partisan claim here. So people, when they have been shown these sites, and these are savvy people, they're kind of students in colleges, high schools, and so on. So they know how to operate the internet. 80% of them can't tell apart the difference on a news site between an actual news story produced on the news site and a sponsored story.
Fantastic.
They can't tell the difference. So if you imagine, you know, someone shares a story on Facebook, let's say it's a sponsored story or a real news story from a website, and they go and they say, oh, CNN said this. And they don't know that this is a sponsored story on CNN versus a real story on CNN.
Doesn't it say it right there in the heading that it's a sponsored? Mm-hmm. Doesn't it say it in the heading? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But people don't know to look for that. If they have never been educated,
they don't know what it means. You and, when it's sponsored.
You and I, all of the people on, you know, who are speaking to each other right now, and I imagine the large majority of your listeners are outliers. We're outliers in our society because we actually care about the truth. We care about the news. We care about rational thinking.
You know, some of this most might have to don't. Do with the fact that news organizations have, for a while now, found it difficult to be profitable. And that maybe, you know, over a long period of time, capitalism does not lend itself to accurate news.
So there are tensions in that. Kind of, you know, between capitalism and news and accuracy. So I definitely agree. But here we're talking about something different. People themselves, ordinary people, are not taught that if something says sponsored content, then it means it's not produced by that credible news organization. Let's say something on CNN says sponsored content. It means it's not produced by CNN.
I don't see how that can be separated from the capitalistic part, because if you look at these sites, even CNN, which, you know, I consider to be a pretty legitimate news site, the sponsored content is made to look like the same links as the regular content, and the word sponsored is very small. All of that is a marketing decision that is made to make the advertising more profitable, and I'm sure the advertisers require that kind of thing. So I think that's got to be tied to them making sure that they're making enough money.
Yes, it is tied to that. I mean, I'm not questioning that. So I'm just talking about right now, what I'm talking about is how people don't have the education to tell apart the difference. You know, one thing comes from CNN, and not to pick apart, I mean, this comes on Slate, this comes on New York Times, everything has sponsored content, Wall Street Journal and so on.
Yeah.
So
I've noticed that some of the websites are a little more transparent about what is sponsored. The even techniques about the location of the advertising not being mixed in with the actual news stories. I think CNN actually mixes them in, which I was disappointed when they started to do that, because that was a decision at a certain time.
I don't think the New York Times money
does that.
Of course. Yep, no question, it helps them make more money, and that causes people to make mistakes. Like I said, 80% of people, according to the study, can't tell apart the difference on, you know, on a website between sponsored news and real news.
Yeah, so you kind of have to know what you're looking for.
Exactly. Anyone who has the money can shape public opinion in that way. And then, of course, because people feel comfortable with the sponsored news as opposed to the real news, they would share the sponsored news. So that's why you have social media being such a problem. Another aspect of social media being a huge problem is deliberate manipulation. And this comes from Russia has been a very big player in the 2016 election in the US. So that was a big problem in deliberate manipulation. There are many of Russian trolls, hackers who are paid by the government to produce fake news and share fake news and disrupt, kind of make fake comments, kind of create an appearance of grassroots support, mainly targeted to support help Trump and attack Hillary Clinton. So though that was another major factor that caused people to make mistakes and become deluded in the 2016 election. And the last factor has been also Republican, kind of conservative alt-right websites. They have used this Facebook and Twitter and so on very aggressively to mislead people. So, for example, Trump's campaign has done a lot of voter suppression efforts. So, for example, they have done things like making cartoons of Hillary Clinton saying the words that African Americans are super predators.
I remember that.
Yep, exactly. So they had a cartoon. I mean, Hillary Clinton, this was in 1997, I think. Hillary Clinton apologized for that. She said that she used the wrong wording, whatever. They made cartoons right now, like in the 2016 election campaign, saying that Hillary Clinton currently, right now, believes that African Americans are super predators. And they targeted those at people on Facebook who are swing voters. So on swing voters who are African-American, obviously, they did that. They did a whole bunch of other things like this. I mean, there were Trump allies, possibly with his campaign as well, but definitely Trump allies made ads that look like real, like Hillary Clinton ads, saying that targeted African-American voters, saying that you can text your vote, and they spread those on Twitter.
So, oh, wow.
Yep. So voter suppression efforts of this sort, which were quite effective. So this is some other stuff that was going on. Because, again, like I said, people can't tell apart things, or it's people who aren't looking for it, people not like the ones we are talking about right now together, or the listeners of your show, they just are not really looking for these things, and they don't know how to parse social media and how to actually tell what is true or not.
Is there any information on how many people actually read the stories that they post? Because I think a problem with social media is like take Twitter, for example. You have Twitter where you're limited to 140 characters. It's it's necessarily and unfortunately vague. It's hard to give a lot of detail. Even if it's a real story, you can't get a lot of detail. I think people just read the headlines and keep scrolling a lot of times.
I bought the upgrade. I get two extra characters.
I should do that.
Yes. So on Twitter, people can link to stories. That's one. Second of all, what people on Twitter have found to be quite effective is creating images. So the fake Clinton ads had images saying that looked like real Clinton ads saying, you know, skip the lines, text the vote to whatever, five numbers, and, you know, paid for by the Hillary Clinton for president campaign. So that's an image. Images are quite
well. This is something that
powerful.
Facebook. This is something that Facebook has also started to emphasize, and a lot of groups or organizations on Facebook, rather than using posts or links, will now emphasize sort of meme images because they travel more effectively and they get more attention, they get more likes, they get shared more often than stories or just regular posts.
Yes, exactly.
And
I
was going to say, I think part of this, it kind of comes to this information era. So we have so much information. You know, I have thousands of friends on Facebook. I see hundreds of posts. So you have Twitter, you have Facebook, there's other social media sites. So you're just kind of bombarded with this information. And I think a lot of people are sort of reducing to sort of bite-sized tidbits. People are less likely to sit down and read a long, informative article and much more likely to share a meme or a picture that captures how they feel in a moment. And I think that's part of the issue.
Yep.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
So this is what I was talking about earlier with the rise of social media. That's one. And second, effective strategies to manipulate people on social media, too. And the alt-right, kind of the conservatives, have been very effective at it in a way that the liberals, progressives have not. So, for example, if you look at the statistics on social media sharing, you see that of the stories that were shared, fake news stories on Facebook that were favorable to Trump and not favorable to Clinton, you had something like 30 million shares versus pro-Clinton, anti-Trump, you had something like 7 million shares for fake news stories. So you have clear disbalance in fake news favoring Trump. Also, all the stuff that Russia made was pro-Trump, and there are a whole bunch of other things that were strongly favorable to Trump that were taking place. Also, in the UK election, lots of stuff favorable to the Leave campaign, fake news, lies, deceptions, that in both cases definitely tipped things over the edge.
I want to let you guys know that as an educator, the concept of fake news is now part of what we are teaching. So I think that it's really easy to be thinking about these things and to be really depressed. But in reality, the concept, even the term fake news is helping to kind of inoculate people against this, at least to a better degree than it was before, because it's become part of the public conversation. Schools are teaching kids that this is now a skill that it's expected in high schools to teach kids to at least put some effort into differentiating between fake news and real news, which I think is a really good trend in general, because it's a trait of a skeptic to initially, when you get information, to question it. So I think that this is high on the radar now. I don't think that it's the kind of thing that will ever go away, because it reminds me of spam. You know, when you get an email that is spam, when this first happened before there were spam filters, you know, maybe you would read a few of them. And I remember when spam first was getting started, and you were like, "What is going on here?" And then pretty soon it became public knowledge that this is what marketing people do, and it became pretty easy to ignore. Now, it didn't end spam. It still happens. Because it's so cheap to produce that it doesn't matter if 0.001 people click on it, that's enough to justify the expense or trouble to generate it. So I think
we're
stuck with fake news, but best we can do is just try to inoculate more people from it.
When I think I read something that 70 or 80% of email traffic or data is almost entirely dedicated to spam.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority, which it doesn't surprise me. You look at snail mail. The vast majority of mail I get is garbage.
Yes.
Advertisements.
I've looked through your mail, and he's completely right.
Yes. Yep. This is absolutely true. So this is something that we are actually working on as part of Intentional Insights that I mentioned. And with the education stuff, the Pro-Truth-Pledge Project, which is a major part of our effort, we have a school principal, a number of teachers who are putting together a curriculum centered around the Pro-Truth-Pledge in order to address fake news and lies and deceptions in politics more broadly, not simply in social media, but from a much more broad and high-up framework. How do you think about all of this stuff that you engage with? And then they engage with all points of the 13 points of the Pro-Truth Pledge, and then go through each of the points, talk about each of the points, and how it helps address fake news and lies and deceptions in politics, and then they create blog posts and podcasts around each of the 13 points, which is a very nice and comprehensive way of getting students inoculated against lies and deceptions.
Well, and I guess what I'm interested in is this seems like really the only way to fight this kind of thing, because you can't – well, so the alternative right has done a much better job at utilizing these biases to their advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess if we look at the left, or if we look at what we should do in the political sphere,
mm-hmm.
It almost seems – unfortunate that the answer to winning is to play ball, whereas in the long term it seems, you know, the effort to educate people is good, but how do we make gains now in the political sphere, because the losses are fairly damaging?
So I think we have two options, and we can play the short term game and compete on the same field. And there are a number of liberals, you know, the Democratic Party, that's where it's heading. That's what the DNC is doing. It's saying we need to adopt Trump's tactics and you know, go and do the same stuff, adopt the populist rhetoric. I mean, this is what so many people in the Democratic Party are saying that they want to do. Now, that's one route. But then what do you have? Then you have a race to the bottom. Because we've seen, I mean... the big news recently in politics has been the body slamming of the reporter by the new congressman who won the election in Montana, right? Uh-huh. That has been enabled by the violence that Trump has solicited in his rallies and the condemning of reporters. So this is kind of the next step, actual physical violence against reporters. So people are going further. Now you'll see that stuff happening more and more. You know, people. I remember when Trump was elected, and people were saying, "Oh, he'll be the worst. There will be no one like him." And I was saying, "No, Trump has shown that these tactics are effective. There will be many more like him and worse than him." And now we have a clear example of, you know, more like him and worse than him actually physically attacking reporters as opposed to just attacking them verbally. And you'll have many more like this. And many Democrats are going down this route because of this very short-term orientation. What about the long-term? What about when they go low, we go high? What about that? What will actually help address our society's problems? Like Michelle Obama said, you know, when they go low, we go high. This situation, you know, competing on the short-term is going to get us into more and more lies and deceptions. And that will just end up in us not being able to differentiate between anybody in the political sphere and just going like, okay, they're all liars and therefore I shouldn't vote. And that, so research shows that there have been many societies like this. This is a major reason why a number of democracies have become corrupt and authoritarian states, because the end of this sort of stuff is an authoritarian ruler coming to power and saying, our system is totally messed up, you should give me all power so that I can fix things. And this is what happened in Russia about 8 years ago. This is what's happening in Turkey right now. This is what happened in countries like France, in countries like Spain, Italy, Germany, Portugal. This has happened in major Western democracies. So you have this very short-term orientation, and that's where it leads to. The other option is to differentiate between the political parties and say, hey, they can go down this short-term route of lies and deceptions, and then that's one. But we will take the high road, and we will orient toward the path of truth and reason. And those people who care about truth and reason then can know that this is the party that is associated with truth and reason. I think that's a much more effective long-term strategy that will help our society and will actually prevent this deterioration going down this short-term route. So that's what I'm really working on.
Hmm? I'm going to propose another solution. And it's going to sound weird, but I'm actually not kidding.
Is it moving to Canada?
No. No. And Chalmer, you're going to like this because it actually relates to cheese.
Okay.
Okay, you ready?
Moving to the moon.
No. So I don't know. I don't know if it's still used, but and I don't know if it was actually good, but I use it as an example. A while back, there was on cheese labels the real seal. You remember anything about this?
Yeah.
So it was a little seal that said, look, this has been independently evaluated as being real cheese, not, you know, the fake oil-based products.
Mm.
And so I think that a conversation should be had about news stories having some sort of label on them that says that they've been checked by certain fact-checking organizations, and that mm-hmm. if this becomes part of the public understanding, that they know that if they're looking at a news story that doesn't have that seal on it, then this has not been fact-checked. Now I know that I should treat it with skepticism. Now, if you think about that, the reason why that wouldn't work is because people would mistrust the organizations that did the vetting, right?
So this is an important question, and this is something that we are working on at Intentional Insights with the Rational Politics Project, quite close to this. We're actually not fact-checking organizations, but people. So if your listeners go to protruthpledge.org, so again, that's protruthpledge.org, and the host can go to this as well. What we are setting up is a project to fact-check not individual news stories, but people who are producing news stories, politicians, radio show hosts, podcast hosts, like the three of you, political commentators and analysts like myself, people who are there and who are, you know, either telling the truth or not telling the truth. So this is a project that is intended to address the lies and deceptions in our politics. And this is not, you know, this is not a partisan project. This is for conservatives and liberals to engage with. So it's crossing the partisan divides. It's about getting everyone who cares about the truth to sign the pro-truth pledge and show that they care about the truth, that this is an important issue to them, and then to engage in helping fact-check public figures who sign the pro-truth pledge and make sure that they all commit to the truth and engage with the truth in a thorough way. So it's informed by behavioral science and crowdsourcing. So behavioral science research on how people are likely to orient toward the truth and how do you get them rewards and punishments to orient them toward the truth, and crowdsourcing so that everyone who engages with the pro-truth pledge can play some part of a role in crowdsourcing the truth, and whether just by signing it and showing their concern or becoming more actively involved with it and actually checking the words of public figures who engage with the pro-truth pledge.
I'm not sure. I'm actually not sure. I mean, if you know me, I can always you can always change my mind. But initially, I'm skeptical of this, and let me tell you why. As someone with a philosophy background, I worry that this is drifting into the genetic fallacy, which is to say that an argument is not good because of its source, which is not a logical way of looking at arguments. So,
I would actually question that. That is a logical way if you can provide credibility to the source. If you know the source, based on probabilistic thinking, if you know the source has been truthful in the past, then, and if you know the source is being currently monitored by people who check that for its truthfulness, you should trust the source in the same way that you would trust actual news stories produced by CNN or New York Times or Wall Street Journal as credible sources.
I don't know. I mean, this is there's some traction there, but it is called a fallacy for a reason. And that's because, I guess, you know, the analogy I always gave my logic students is, you know, I don't think he exists, but if he did, Satan himself could occasionally be truthful.
Yeah, which is what I'm saying is the point. What you want to see is a reputation for truthfulness.
Well, I don't think Satan would sign the pledge.
What?
I don't think Satan would sign the pledge. I think he wouldn't.
Of course, Satan wouldn't sign the pledge. That's my point. You want to see, I mean, the point is a reputation for truthfulness. If you have to, let me make it colloquial. If you have two friends, one of them always told you the truth and the other lied occasionally, who would you trust? You know, would you trust your friend who told you the truth, or would you trust your friend who lied?
Well, I think the rules of reason say you don't trust either. Yeah, the rules of reason say you don't trust either. You examine the argument on their own merits, because you're not just looking at facts, you're looking at connections of facts to convince people of conclusions.
Yeah, which is why humans are not robots, and they don't use reason. They use emotions, and they use heuristics.
Yeah, but shouldn't we be trying to be more rational rather than emotional and examine everything case by case?
We don't have time. No, we don't have time to do that. I mean, you would just talked for, you know, half an hour about how people don't have time to fact check everything, and how what we should do is have ways we can quickly tell whether someone is generally a truthful person or not. We can't. We simply can't. We're not living in, you know, if we remember the Federalist Papers, and if the government, you know, if the government was made up of angels, then you wouldn't need like a democratic system, right? You wouldn't need checks and balances. And if people were angels, you wouldn't need a government. So if people were angels who were using reason all the time and just telling truth and so on, then you wouldn't need a government, you wouldn't need fact checkers, you wouldn't need anything like this. This is different. People are not angels. People don't use reason.
I'll give you a little bit.
We shouldn't use reason as a basis for evaluating, you know, we shouldn't assume that people will always use reason. There is no time. I don't have time to evaluate and thoroughly fact check all the articles I read. I go on the reputation. Is this a credible source? Can I trust this person? You know, has this person lied in the past?
I mean, I'll give you a little bit on this that, yeah, you can't fact check everything yourself. And so, sure, there is a little bit of trust involved, but it's not just trust. It's also some probabilities. If you have a certain number of organizations all corroborating something, then the odds of that being not truthful go down. Reason is still involved in this. I'm not going to say that you don't have time to use reason. Sure. You certainly have to take the time to use reason.
Yeah, yes. I think so too.
I would say that you don't want to take the time to fact check articles. You want to use reason at a higher level. You know, what is the probability that this is likely to be correct? This is where I'm going to the two friends again.
Sure.
You know, if you have a friend who lied to you occasionally in the past versus one who has always told you the truth, I would not take the time to fact check the stuff that the person who has told me the truth in the past. That's reason. That's, you know, I have clear logical reasons based on probabilities and prior evaluations of probability. Now, the person who has lied to me in the past, I will definitely take the time to fact check.
I think there's some traction to this.
I actually do agree with that. Like, going off of reputation, and in the scientific community, we have trusted sources for scientific papers. They're peer-reviewed, the journals that we get our information from. And so we can trust those sources and say that this paper published by this journal, I can trust this, and I don't go back. Yes, I go back and fact-check maybe for fun, but I can feel secure in reading this paper from a particular journal that is a credible source. So I can see where he's coming from. I was initially disagreeing, but I have maybe changed my mind a little bit.
Well, I also think that when it comes to this kind of thing, for me, when I'm looking at various sources, if a source... Sorry, I have a siren outside my window.
They're coming for you.
What did you do?
What did I do? If I'm being bombarded with information, this is something that I notice when you get into an argument with a conspiracy theorist. They will, rather than sticking to a particular point, they will bombard you with claims and information that you can't possibly refute or check into. So I feel like social media is kind of the same way. You're bombarded with information. If I have a credible source, I'm more likely to look into, consider, and verify that information to make sure that it's accurate, because it's more worth my time, because it's more likely to be rewarding. But if I spend all my time trying to fact check everything that comes across my desk or across my Facebook, I would be doing that as a full-time job, and there's just no way that you can handle all that information. So I think the credibility argument isn't so much a genetic fallacy as it is a practical means of investing your time.
It's certainly not foolproof, though, because if I were a politician, I would take the pledge, and then if I was ever caught in a lie, I would just say it was innocent, I just didn't know. And that's not the same as a lie. And there would be no way to control for that. And I am going to hold that you do use reason even in these kinds of debates with conspiracy theorists as well, because... you know, if I'm talking with somebody who is a conspiracy theorist or is a very religious, and they're trying to convince me by truth by verbosity, I will oppose that by isolating a key claim that is more important amongst all the claims, and then discuss and focus on that. And that decision of which claim to focus on is a process of reason. And then once you show that that claim is not legitimate, then you can kind of say, well, okay, now the ball is in your court to prove all these other claims and get back to me when you can do that. That is also a move that is based in reason. So I think that obviously it's correct to say that there's got to be some trust, and trust in qualified authority, but there's also got to be trust in rational processes, and people need to be better trained in those too.
Yes, I agree that people need to be better trained in those too. I would question the claim that I have argued with plenty of conspiracy theorists and stuff. They don't stick to points. When you isolate a point, and they don't stick to points. That's not the way it happens in reality. I have a conversation with someone, that's not the way it goes. You know, when you have a conversation online with someone who gives you a whole bunch of points, and you isolate a point, and that person, you know... and then you say, come back when you prove the other points, then that person will just say, oh, what about these points? Haha, you're not willing to engage with me. I win. That's not the way that the real world works. You know, we are right now talking among people who actually care about truth and reason. And I tell you what, if the whole world was like this, we wouldn't need the pro-truth pledge. You know, who cares?
Right. Yeah.
The world is different, my friends. The world is different. The world is not made up of people like us. I think what you're talking about is true.
So that's a good point taken. I think it is easier if done online. If you're talking with someone in person, it's a little bit easier. At least I find it possible to isolate, to slow them down and isolate individual points. But, you know, I've been a teacher for 12 years now, so I kind of have to do that face-to-face regularly. So... Online, a person is remote, so they can ignore what you say more easily. They can you know, dig around on their spare time and form a witty, trolly response. So, yeah, I think that's probably true.
And not only is it true online, it's also true when you engage with people who aren't in person, who aren't very reason-oriented, which is conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
If you isolate a point, you know, and they will still come back at you with all the other points, and, you know, they will try to overwhelm you with information. I mean, they have rhetorical strategies that are based not on reason.
I'm immune.
You can't...
That's because you're a high school teacher.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, unfortunately, conspiracy theorists are not trapped audiences like the students. I mean, I'm a professor myself. I know what you're talking about.
Yes.
So that's different. Having a trapped audience of, like, students in the classroom to whom I can, you know, lecture is different. Right. And who there's a power dynamic there where their grades are dependent on me is different than talking to your grandma who is telling you about, you know, that climate change is a hoax created by, you know, little space aliens or whatnot. That's different. Those are two different conversations.
Well, you could just, you know, hold her back from getting to the fridge, and then eventually she'll cave.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
It's a brand new teaching technique.
Yes. So that's not going to work. The pro-truth pledge is made for the real world. Yeah. It's made so that we can evaluate people. Now, we can talk about the pro-truth pledge has specific aspects which are meant to prevent politicians from lying and, you know, deceiving people. So we can talk about those aspects and those dynamics. It's been thoroughly evaluated by behavioral scientists, not only behavioral scientists, but actual politicians who have worked on creating the structure of the pro-truth pledge and who care about promoting truth in politics. And so to ensure that it will actually work and will prevent politicians from abusing it and so on.
At least prevent them from deliberately.
Can you give politicians a score using this pro-truth pledge, like a Rotten Tomato score, or the science
yeah,
you the use science, like the...
Three-star politician.
We decided not to do that.
We decided to kind of go with another route, because that wouldn't be... we decided to evaluate... We'll create a public database of politicians who took the pro-truth pledge, and that's in the works. There are a number of politicians who took the pro-truth pledge and who have, basically, they have rewards and punishments that are part of the pro-truth pledge. So if a politician or a commentator or a radio show host takes the pro-truth pledge, anyone who is a public figure, they have an opportunity to provide a brief paragraph about why they took the pro-truth pledge, and free links to their social media presence. Now, ordinary citizens, you know, listeners of the show who are ordinary citizens and anyone else, we encourage everyone, strongly encourage people to take the pro-truth pledge and sign up to the email list. That then gets sent out, the politician statement, in twice monthly newspapers, newsletters to all people who took the pro-truth pledge. That gets politicians, radio show hosts, and so on, various forms of rewards, reputational rewards, because they get to be known as a credible politician or a credible news show or whatever, blog or blogger or a credible podcast host. That way they get more traffic and they get more listened to. So let's say a podcast host, you know, who would you listen to? Joe podcast host who hasn't signed the pro-truth pledge or someone who has signed the pro-truth pledge and committed to the truth? So you get more traffic that way. Same thing for politicians. They get more credibility if they sign the pro-truth pledge, and so on. Now, for people who took the pro-truth pledge, did you have a question?
I did. How are you going to prevent the following scenario? I'm a Republican. I hear about the pro-truth pledge. I, with bravado, say, no, I'm not going to do that. That's just a liberal organization, and all my constituents buy that. Because, you know, you guys are just a bunch of academics, and, you know, you're part of the infrastructure that promotes evolution and all this other stuff. So we don't care about that.
Mm-hmm. Good question. So we are we have evidence showing that Republicans are quite willing to sign the pro-truth pledge.
Really?
Republicans who are not, like, just ordinary off-the-street Republicans. So we have, I'll give you an example. We, one of the ways we promote the pro-truth pledge is going to Rotary clubs. Rotary clubs are clubs of business professionals who tend, according to statistics, to lean Republican. And we had someone go to a Rotary club in Hilliard, Ohio, which is a Republican district that has Republicans, you know, in pretty much, you know, most levels of office. And it's a red district. So it's a red district with red-leaning district with and an organization that's red-leaning within it. So the person, she presented on the pro-truth pledge, and, you know, people were interested, and about 25% of the membership signed up to the pro-truth pledge. So they signed the pro-truth pledge. So you have people who are Republican-leaning in a Republican-leaning district signing the pro-truth pledge. We already have clear evidence that they are. Now, in 2 months, what the local Republican congressperson will be going to speak there. Now, I don't know. I doubt that the local Republican congressperson will take the pro-truth pledge because his name is Pat DeBerry. So he would have to shift his positions on climate change to take the pro-truth pledge, for example, because one of the aspects of the pro-truth pledge is going for along with a scientific consensus. Now, so what happens in the election process? The two Democrats opposing DeBerry, they still have to go for a primary to see which one will oppose DeBerry. They have both taken the pro-truth pledge. So now, when you have the general election runoff, DeBerry goes to the people in the Rotary Club to ask for money, because that's the main reason he's there. They have money. Now, if they find out, 25% of the membership has now taken the pro-truth pledge. If they find out that DeBerry hasn't taken the pro-truth pledge and the two Democrats have taken the pro-truth pledge, which we will inform them of, how likely are they to give DeBerry money, and how likely are they to, you know, vote for DeBerry versus, you know, either sit out the election or something like that? I mean, voting in this case doesn't matter nearly as much as giving DeBerry money. That's what he's there for. So that is an example where we clearly already have evidence that influential Republicans in their local community are taking the pro-truth pledge. And they will likely not support DeBerry in financially as he wishes, or as community leaders in spreading the word about this. So people across the party lines care about the truth. And so we have clear evidence that that's not the scenario that's happening right now.
Huh. Well, I think I'd be interested in, you know, seeing how this, how it progresses. Yeah.
I hope it works. It seems like it's a very practical approach, where it's like, in my mind, I want to be like an idealist and think people should think rationally and check things, which you're right. No one really has enough time in a day to do that.
But yeah. So
one good approach.
When you do check, you're trusting other people. So, you know, if we everybody in this conversation has looked up things on Snopes, for example, or Politico, and, you know, that's just what we do. We're trusting those organizations. So the point earlier is, you know, still valid. It's not
absolutely.
It's not that we don't check anything. It's the method that we're using.
Yes, right. One of the aspects of the pro-truth pledge, when we there, and all the listeners who are following along can take a look on the second FAQ, what is considered misinformation, and one of the aspects of what is considered misinformation is things that go against credible fact-checking organizations, which includes things like Snopes, PolitiFact, FactCheck.org, ABC News, and so on. So, as well as things that go against the scientific consensus. So this pledge is also a means of educating people about what are credible fact-checking organizations and getting them to be invested in these credible fact-checking organizations. Again, as opposed to politicians who are criticizing these fact-checking organizations.
I wonder what we do to raise people's confidence in real news sources again, though. I've seen polls that say that people mistrust the media to like the most amount of mistrust the media has ever had in, I think, ever. I mean, that seems like it's a really big problem.
This is true. Trust in the media among Republicans has fallen from 2015 to 2016 by over half, due to the Trump effect. So by over half, that's incredible and, you know, very sad. So what we do is get journalists, reporters, to take the pro-choice. That is the solution. So getting people, you know, one of the things on the pro-choice pledge is getting on, is putting the pro-choice pledge badge on your website. And also, if you write news stories, to say that, hey, I have taken the pro-choice pledge. And the pro-choice pledge has a clear monitoring system where if someone, anyone who signs up to the pro-choice pledge, can choose to be an advocate for the pro-choice pledge. That's an option. And one of the things you do as an advocate is evaluate public figures, like journalists who took the pro-choice pledge, and politicians and radio show hosts and so on. So you know that if this journalist took the pro-choice pledge, then her stories are going to be evaluated and monitored by others who are ordinary citizens, volunteers, who are advocates, who are evaluating that. So that's a way you get trust back into individual journalists, and that's how you can make them more credible.
Yeah, does Europe have the same problem that America does as far as like conservative people not trusting news? Is that a U.S. phenomenon, yes, or is it also Europe too?
It's also in Europe too. So, for example, in the Brexit Leave campaign, the Leave side, which is the conservative side of the campaign, has been criticizing media and using lies, not nearly as bad as Trump has done, but also that is also a problem. Yes.
Well, shit, that's depressing too.
Well, the fortunate thing about is that the pro-choice pledge is a global project, so we have a number of people who are working on the pro-choice pledge, volunteers in European countries, the UK, in Netherlands, in Portugal, and so on. So the aim is for the pro-choice pledge to start here in the U.S., but it's already, but also expand globally. So it has advocates who are global and who are promoting it around the world.
Well, so we have a little bit of time left. I'm curious, Gleb, what you think ultimately how the Trump presidency will turn out. Do you see him ultimately getting himself impeached? Do you see this sort of just adding to the fervor of the conservative movement? I'm kind of curious what you would expect.
Yeah, I think I see him moving the country. I don't see him realistically getting impeached. I see him moving the country more toward lies and deceptions. And this is what I'm, you know, this is where I see his future, and making things worse, making things like the body slamming of the reporter, you know, something that can happen. Body slamming of the reporter by other Republican politicians, something that can happen. So this is what the pro-choice pledge is meant to respond to. How do we address the lies in politics? How do we address these attacks on credible sources of information? This is my huge concern. That's where I see it moving to. And eventually, whether with Trump or some future presidents, moving into authoritarianism more and more. This is the start of a trend, unfortunately, the start of a trend that, if not reversed, will end us up where, you know, Turkey is right now, or Russia is right now, and where other countries have gone there. Because, you know, what is the force that will reverse the lies and deceptions in politics? And if it's not reversed, we have plenty of historical precedents where they have moved into, unfortunately, authoritarianism.
I'm on your site right now reading the pledge, and I feel really good that this is stuff I already do. I think this is the kind of stuff that people who are concerned with critical thinking and familiar with scientific method and all that, I think that this is almost a no-brainer. So I'll take the pledge.
Excellent.
Yeah, I will too.
Me too.
What about?
Definitely.
Okay. Excellent. So don't forget for each of you to make a blurb about why you took the pledge and mark yourself as a public figure and give a link to the show so that folks know when we send it out to the newsletter that they know that this is a credible show that they can trust, and therefore you will get more listeners. So that's excellent.
Excellent. Well, I think we're at a good stopping point, unless anybody else had some follow-up.
I'm good.
Yeah, I'm good, too. This is great.
Fine.
All right, well, excellent.
Thank you, Gleb, for being on the show.
Yes, pleasure to, quote-unquote, meet you.
What'd you say?
Pleasure to, quote-unquote, meet him.
Yeah.
Meet you virtually, yes.
Yeah, be sure to check out Gleb Sipirsky and Rational Politics, and check out his upcoming book. Thank you, Gleb, for being on the show. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, and I hope all of your listeners will go to protruthpledge.org and sign the pledge.
Absolutely. All right. Well, with that, thank you for joining us on another episode of Alternatives to Thought.